Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome to the Lady Chapel of Westminster Abbey. In fact, this chapel goes by three names. The Henry VII Chapel, he caused this chapel to be built and is buried behind the altar behind me. It's known as the Chapel of the Order of the Bath. You can see the insignia of the Grand Knights of the Order of the Bath. Or the Lady Chapel, because it's dedicated in honour of the Mother of Jesus. Anyway, welcome to this remarkable chapel. The Westminster Abbey Institute, who are providing this lecture this evening, was founded to nurture moral and spiritual values in public life and service. And appropriately, we often hold our lectures in this chapel. Its spring programme this year, called Truth, seeks to explore and defend the place of truth in public life, a topical issue I'm sure you'll agree. I'm delighted to welcome on your behalf Lord Saatchi to chair this evening's lecture. Lord Saatchi is a member of the Institute's Council of Reference, and his biography, along with that of Sir Stephen Lamport, our speaker, is on your seat. Maurice, over to you.
Good evening, everyone. I've seen the lecture because Sir Stephen very kindly let me see it. It is, I can tell you in advance, a superb lecture, and I think you're all going to have a marvellous evening. I would like to introduce it, if you would allow me, in a particular way, which is like this. If I now take off my glasses, and I now drop them, they will fall to the ground. And tomorrow, the sun will rise. I can make these statements with a certain plausibility, although not with any finality, because it is our understanding, isn't it, that even in the natural sciences, nothing can be said with finality. There is no such thing as proof. There is only, as Professor Popper put it, a succession of unsuccessful attempts at falsification. So I believe that the Institute, which was founded by Claire and by Sir Stephen, has followed a magnificent path since its creation in trying to achieve a better understanding of the public service ethos. And this is, as you know, one of a series of lectures by great speakers. And I think there can't be anyone. You've got his CV, you might call it, in front of you. But Sir Stephen, who has been a diplomat for 15 years, our man in various places, private secretary to the Prince of Wales for 10 years, and then Receiver General of Westminster Abbey for 10 years. I don't think there can be anyone who would be able to address this not just difficult but practically impossible subject more intelligently and more thoughtfully than Sir Stephen. And of course there is nowhere that could possibly be a more appropriate setting for discussion and an understanding of truth than this place, with all the awe that it inspires in terms of the search for truth for hundreds of years. So may I introduce Sir Stephen Lamport to give this lecture.
Maurice, thank you very much for your kind words, and thank you for setting the bar so high for me to climb. I'm very grateful to you, as I always am, but thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, there are three characters in 19th and 20th century fiction who illustrate to me the lesson of why truth matters. And they are Augustus Melmotte, Nicholas Salmanovich Rubishoff, and Winston Smith. The Way We Live Now is one of Anthony Trollope's longest novels. Melmotte is the villain of the story, an unlovable, an unscrupulous, self-made man whose enormous wealth and success, including I should add, inviting the Emperor of China to dinner in his London house, and in being elected the MP for Westminster. His success is based on an unending series of untruths, which lead in the end to the collapse of his financial empire, his disgrace, and his suicide. Rubishov is the anti-hero of Koestler's Darkness at Noon, a successful party apparatchik in Stalin's Russia whose life is ended by a bullet in the back of his head because truth, as defined by those in power, has moved beyond Rubishov's own set of beliefs to the point where what he once stood for can no longer be tolerated. And Winston Smith, the hero of Orwell's 1984, moves us a step further in the realm of untruth to a world in which truth has no existence beyond the definition of the day. Winston's job is to extinguish yesterday's truth to the ever-changing new version handed down by the party. This is a world in which any genuine meaning of truth is utterly abolished. Now, let me say straight away that Orwell's cry of utter despair at a world in which truth has lost all relevance to our lives is neither my starting point nor my conclusion. My argument to you is rather that truth counts. It matters that it's under attack and that we need to be alert to the damage of a journey which might lead in just that Winston Smith direction. And if you say to me, but all your examples are just fiction, that's not the real world, I would simply reply that fiction can be both a powerful symbol and a reflection of the world around us. Just remember, if you will, Vita Sackville-West's preface to All Passions Spent, where she writes, "No character in this book is entirely fictitious." I should explain my starting point. I speak to you not as a philosopher, psychologist, a sociologist, or indeed a theologian. I'm not trying to shadow a Kant, a Nietzsche, or a Hegel, setting out a worldview which any right-thinking person must accept. I speak to you simply as someone with a background in public life and public service for most of my career. And just to echo what Morris has just said, I was 15 years a diplomat, serving overseas and at home, including as a private secretary to two ministers. 10 years in the royal household as private secretary to the Prince of Wales, where I lived very much on the front line of public service, public duty, and a commitment to the quest for a better society. And 10 years here as Receiver General, where I would hope the commitment of the Abbey, of this great church and institution, to integrity and truth can be taken utterly for granted. It's on that basis that my intention is simply to put to you my personal perception, and you may well disagree with it, and that, of course, is the point of occasions like this. But I simply want to explain to you what I see as truth, why it matters in terms of sustaining a civilized society, what that might mean in today's world, and where, if I do, I see some grounds for hope. Can indeed truth be sustained? But first, what exactly do I mean by truth? Whatever it is, truth is not easy. Truth has been for centuries a basic problem to which philosophers have never agreed an answer. The concept is elusive once you try to pigeonhole it into a definition. Is it knowable at all? Is all truth simply relative, an ever-changing approximation? We're always searching for it, consciously or unconsciously. Seeking after the truth to explain events is, after all, the object of all historical explanation. But is that possible if historical explanation is simply conditioned by one's own ideology? Why, for example, should the Whig interpretation of history be more truthful than the Marxist? The Whig historian tells you that the story of Britain is the story of the inevitable, interrupted, yes, by events like the Commonwealth in the 1650s, but in essence, inevitable progress of Britain from medieval autocracy towards ever greater liberty and enlightenment, culminating in the 20th century story of Britain as a liberal democracy and constitutional monarchy. The Marxist historian, on the other hand, sees human society as a logical product of the internal material conditions of the time. These material conditions evolve because each society contains within itself the ineluctable seeds of its own destruction. Or is the march of events the doing, as others argue, of individuals, like Frederick the Great, or ideas, like nationalism or liberalism? Is truth just a means of exercising power and political influence? My truth is more powerful than yours, and I have the means to impose it. Is there any such thing as the whole or the absolute truth, as in their different ways Plato, Christianity, and Hinduism assert? What of theological truth, which collects around the person of God or the figure of Jesus Christ? Take your pick of any of these many approaches to truth. They are all important parts of the story. The debate is endless, fascinating, unsettling, and confusing. My point, however, is that truth is not simply an abstract concept, best left to the men of thought rather than the men of action. If that were the case, where would it leave most of us who have to grapple every day in our different roles with the world around us as we find it? We who have to act at whatever level rather than just think. Where does truth take you in terms of action? In my view, a very long way, since truth is equally an operative dynamic. It informs the important drivers of action, like integrity, honesty, scrutiny, and a sense of history. There is, for me, an ineluctable link between truth and reality, between truth and the facts. If I do this, what happens? We have to make sense of the world and make choices on the basis of our understanding. Choices which should be made, according to Christianity and to many religions, in a way aimed at creating good rather than evil. Well, my own understanding of truth against this background is one related to action. It may seem to you a little pedestrian or simple-minded. I suspect the philosophers among you would say it begs more questions than it answers. But to me, there's a powerful relationship between what I see as truth and the honest pursuit of approaching as near as possible to fact and reality. Let me say that again. The honest pursuit of approaching as near as possible to fact and reality. That is a definition which has meaning for me, and on that basis I myself can make some sense of the world around me. So even if we can never be sure what the truth actually means, that's to say, whole or absolute truth, there are still many truths about our world and many facts defining the story around us which cannot be denied. For example, it's a fact that Germany invaded Belgium on the 4th of August 1914. It's a fact that on 11 November 1918, the armistice was signed and the guns in Europe fell silent. It's a fact that John Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas on 22nd November 1963. It's a fact that Churchill died on the 24th of January 1965. Facts matter. They're not answers, but if you ignore or deny them, you will have no hope of interpreting their meaning or deciding what the right action or actions in response to them might be. Understanding the meaning of those facts is, of course, where the challenge begins. Germany's invasion of Belgium in 1914 was a story to Britain and its allies of unacceptable German aggression and brutalism, which threatened the whole civilized future of Europe. That's our understanding of the truth of those facts. To Germany, however, this was a necessary and defensible exercise by the nation of the need to protect the security and interests of its people in an increasingly threatening Europe. Likewise, the armistice of 1918 was for us the final triumph of goodness and reason over 4 years of horror and suffering imposed by a wicked and immoral regime. To Germany, it was an act of humiliation and abuse which led to the suffering of the 1920s and the triumph in the next decade of Nazism. So beware the simple victor's view as the answer to truth. Truth has to be wisely discovered, situations analysed, reason applied. Snap decisions are not the key to truth, and events may only declare their true meaning as time goes on. And it is, I think, important to appreciate this. So how does truth, as I have defined it, matter in practice? If truth is the basis of trust, and I shall come back to this point, and trust is the bedrock of consent on which representative government depends, then truth absolutely does matter. Two simple examples where perceptions of the truth clearly do matter. The latest turn of the Brexit argument about the UK's likely economic performance after withdrawal is one of them. Both sides of the debate argue on the basis of how they see the facts. One is optimistic and the other pessimistic. Each side accuses the other, in their words, of selling snake oil. The search here for the truth is elusive. The likelihood of possibilities is confusing. But for both sides, convincing others of their truth is what matters. That is, that their truth gets closer to the facts than anyone else's. This is an ageless political fact of life. It's the essence of debate and discussion. Let me give another example from the 19th century. The deeply passionate debate in the 1840s over the Corn Laws was exactly one in which both sides claimed a monopoly of the truth. On one side, the landed classes who sought to maintain agricultural protection to keep prices high. On the other, the free traders who argued that abolition would bring cheaper food and an end to famine. For one side, repeal would ruin British farming. For the other, keeping the existing laws would do just the same. When Robert Peel, the Prime Minister, changed his mind in 1845 from support to repeal, the public debate between the two sides was as vitriolic in its own terms as Brexit is in ours. There will always be different versions of the truth, but there is no doubt that persuading others of the truth counts, whichever side of the debate you're on, because belief in your version of the truth gives you the means to pursue the policy which you think should flow from it. That's precisely why the proper search for truth matters so much. The key question then becomes, which of the versions of that truth approaches closer and more honestly the facts and reality? Let me now put this in the wider context of the world that we live in. What helps to create and sustain a civilized society? What, as St. Augustine asks, might be the difference between a state and a gang of thieves? That, I believe, is the place of truth. And what is a moral imperative to work for truth? For me, this is a Christian perspective. Its hallmark is the pursuit of good, of justice, of fairness. And history shows us that we've frequently been very bad at achieving this to any standard at all. It demonstrates equally that in a myriad of different ways relating to time and context, these principles have inspired and driven much of what I would call good human endeavour. And they've been notably absent when these aims have been replaced by the pursuit of power and by envy, aggression, intolerance, inequality, and evil. Look at Rwanda in the 1990s, Zimbabwe under Mugabe, or the Congo, both under Mobutu and now, sadly, returning to a state of terrible chaos and repression under President Kabila. So where is truth in all this? What part does it play? The answer is simple. Truth helps to define what the civilized behavior of a civilized society is actually based on. At the level of the family, for example, why were we as children brought up never to tell lies? because an untruth is equivalent to deception, and deception is morally wrong. Now, this is not Tom Stoppard's cynical description of truth in his play Jumpers, where George, the professor of moral philosophy, says, "On the whole, people should tell the truth all right and keep their promises and so on, but on the sole grounds that if everyone went around telling lies and breaking their word as a matter of course, normal life would be impossible. Telling lies is not sinful, but simply antisocial." Nor is this Machiavelli's advice to the prince when he argues, "A sensible leader cannot and must not keep his word if by doing so he puts himself at risk. If all men were good, this would be bad advice, but since they're a sad lot and will be keeping their promises to you, you need hardly to keep yours to them." Now, Machiavelli may work in the short term for the cynical and the unscrupulous, but truth is an absolutely vital component of the long-term good of society. The Machiavelli option, in fact, destroys good governance, since lying in practice demeans and cheapens a political system and can threaten the whole basis of civilized existence. We can see all too clearly when it goes wrong in the blatant distortion of the need to link ideas, and therefore behavior, to a justifiable or honest understanding of the facts. Think simply of slavery, of Nazism, or of apartheid. It's not good enough to argue that those who supported these systems are simply being honest in their own beliefs. That is relativism in the extreme. The essence of truth is that this honesty should reflect as responsible a view as possible of the facts as we know them at the time. That test may help us understand the past, not necessarily to excuse it. Just as scientific truth, which is constantly evolving, has to be tested always against as honest an understanding as possible of fact and reality as they're known to us. How, therefore, does the role of truth actually matter in our world today? What are the implications for us all if societies or cultures or practices which place no value on the pursuit or maintenance of truth? It's been implicit, I think, in what I've said, that truth is about sincerity, authenticity, integrity, and mutual understanding. The opposite of truth is, as I've said, the lie. Now, the lie is not about making mistakes, but about the intention behind action, the intention to mislead others when they expect honest communication from us. And the essence of lies, of course, is that they beget more lies in order to maintain belief in the original lie, and so to maintain the deception. As someone put it, every lie limits our future. More than that, there's a vital link between truth, integrity, and trust. Lying destroys trust and breeds both cynicism and relativism. This has huge implications for societies and systems of government because the lies of the powerful lead us to distrust governments. And it's not a long journey from distrusting individual politicians and governments to distrusting the political systems on which they are based. And its perception, by the way, increased by the demonization of political debate, which distances us further from the means to fasten on the truth, both by distorting the words and opinions of one's opponent and by denying the honesty of anyone who disagrees with one's own point of view. The perceived gap between truth, honesty, and integrity is sadly part of the contemporary malaise of British politics at its most extreme in the Brexit debate, and is not going to be ending soon. And the malaise lies equally, I should add, in our, or certainly in my, perception of the administration of Donald Trump. It's important to understand the underlying nature of what is happening before us. In political discourse, the gap between the real and the imaginary is disappearing. There is now simply too much evidence that the consensus that the truth matters in political debate and that telling the truth is a priority is in fact collapsing. Prudent conduct for the voter or the politician begins to look more like a matter of choosing sides than evaluating evidence. Consider again the public debate on the EU referendum. The claim that the £350 million Britain would save each week from its contribution to the EU could be added to the funding of the NHS, a claim then only to be twisted or denied after the EU referendum result, was one huge example of the disappearance of truth in political debate. Or how would I, as a voter in Cornwall, the poorest county in England and a beneficiary of massive EU regional funding over decades, vote with such an overwhelming majority in the county to leave? As one lady interviewed by the BBC in a Midland shopping centre during the campaign disturbingly told us, "I don't know what the EU is all about, but I'm voting to leave." That sombre lesson of the campaigns leading up to the EU referendum goes hand in hand with the attitude which has come to be known in shorthand as post-truth. The Oxford English Dictionary defines post-truth in this way. It says, "Circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief." This is the modern way of realizing Nietzsche's late 19th century destructive view that there are no facts, only interpretations. Or as one contemporary Russian political scientist has put it, "Truth is a matter of belief. There are no such things as facts." The danger is that in this political culture, whatever is purveyed by those with authority as the facts, the more exposed society becomes to a story which need bear little relation to any objective fact. The closer, that is, we edge towards the world of George Orwell's Winston Smith. As Winston's interrogator puts it, "Reality exists in the human mind and nowhere else. Whatever the party holds to be truth is truth." We are increasingly looking at a world which manipulates facts to create its own truth. Truth becomes a matter of my personal opinion today. That opinion may be different tomorrow. If it is, I may be tempted to ignore or even deny the view I gave you yesterday. This, in essence, is the world of the alternative facts of the Trump administration. At the instant soundbite tweets of the president, unthought through and unrelated to the reality around him, as though truth can be reduced to 140 characters and is not a product of care, of reason, and of effort. As though complexity can be denied and only the short cut provides real understanding. And this is the world of the unreal debate carried on by his advisor Kellyanne Conway a year ago about the size of the crowd witnessing the presidential inauguration. Where, I ask, was truth in that debate? The president's tweets bring me to the second longer-term threat to the cherishing of truth in our daily lives. And this is an aspect of the impact of social media on truth. This goes beyond a concern about the quality of contemporary political debate or about the distortion of truth by those in authority. This elemental neglect of truth goes deeper. It stems from the most profound change in the nature of our communications over the last two decades. The essence of much social media in the form it now exists is that attitudes and personal feelings seem often to be more important than facts. This brings us quickly, if we are not careful, to the danger of emotion triumphing over truth, truth as I've tried to define it. For the exalting of the importance of my view simply because it is mine. It also neuters the innate values which we need to find our way towards the truth, the virtues, as I've said, of discernment, of scrutiny, and wisdom. The power of the social media approach is, I believe, reinforced by the increasing tendency to accept as true only that information which fits our own opinions, instead of making the effort to base our opinions on the evidence out there. And this trend lies alongside an increasing phenomenon which anyone with a Twitter account can claim to be a source of news. Of course, the claim may be dismissed out of hand, but the worry about this journey is that unless we are vigilant, it becomes ever harder to distinguish fact from fiction. Everyone and no one becomes an expert, even though we are now told by some politicians that the day of the expert is over, since he or she is unnecessary and untrustworthy. Another victim, by the way, of the assault on truth. I'm putting an extreme view to make my point that once more the gap between fact and opinion, between the real and the imaginary, and between emotion and truth is widening before our eyes. And the impact of this is that much greater because of the extraordinarily powerful marriage today between culture and technology. Data on the web is immediately available to everyone, instantly and across the globe. That data is often raw and unfiltered, and probably too often unchecked and unanalyzed. And one result of the instant communication which lies at the heart of social media, where in that well-known phrase, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting its boots on. Indeed, research published only last week found that fake stories spread on social media significantly further, faster, and deeper than true stories. At its worst, therefore, there has never been a faster way to propagate a lie than to post it online. It is most nefarious when it is deliberate, like the activities of Russian hacking, for which convincing evidence grows, to influence the US presidential election in 2016. It may equally be entirely innocent, for example, simply reporting a story which happens to fit with our own preconceptions. But the result can be equally powerful and equally destructive, and each benefits from a culture which may be unwilling or unable to check the facts or to exercise responsible judgment. Data and truth are not the same thing. There are, of course, counter-arguments. There's a growing view that we are beginning to see a return to the more developed and thoughtful writing of the traditional media. I certainly hope so. I know that a commitment to the pursuit of truth in its reporting and analysis is deeply embedded in the BBC. That's a continuing source of hope. There's a view that parts of our digital world are helping establish a greater truth for us. Wikipedia is described as a powerful example of a myriad source of facts, helping to establish and balance those facts in a self-regulatory way, which brings an ever-increasing closeness to truth. Now, I don't dispute the integrity of that argument. Wikipedia may indeed be a bulwark of truth in a digital age. But alongside the importance of this Encyclopedia Britannica of the web lies the wider anarchy of unsubstantiated opinion all around us, which is easily and pervasively presented as fact. And the equal risk of an unspoken denial of the importance of what I would call inherited knowledge, contained not least in our books, which one generation bequeaths to the next. These trends do increase the challenge to truth. The further our use of artificial intelligence comes to dominate our methods of communicating, the way in which we relate to the world around us, the way in which we think and reflect and act, the more worrying the longer-term implications become, and the more we need to recognize the implications of where we are. That recognition is vital. As Simon Sharma said in a recent broadcast about the cruel destruction of Palmyra in Syria in recent years, he says, "We recognize what civilization is by the shock of its imminent loss." I have argued that the sustaining of truth is under threat, and that the maintaining of truth in our political society and our culture matters mightily. But this is not, at least not yet, a doctrine from me of unadulterated gloom and despair. So where do I look for hope and reassurance? Where might we search for the values which should inspire the civilized society I maintain is a fundamentally precious part of of our shared lives? And where do we look for those constant and unchanging values which over centuries we recognize and have tried, however imperfectly, to realize? I want to conclude by putting to you two sources of comfort to me, one about public service, whose moral underpinning the Westminster Abbey Institute exists to foster, and one about belief. In 1995, the Committee on Standards in Public Life, established the previous year by John Major, published in its first report 7 Principles of Public Life, the Nolan Principles, which set out a code of good practice for all government departments. These 7 principles may be self-evident to some of you, but they're important for us all as a guide to excellence in public service generally. They have been slightly amended over the years, but they bear, I think, repeating. They are selflessness, integrity, objectivity, accountability, openness, honesty, and leadership. These principles are, in their essence, a reaffirmation of the central place in public service of truth as I have defined it. They reflect a striving after truth. Truth inhabits them all. Without a powerful sense of truth lying at the heart of them, they would have no meaning or impact. That identity with truth as a goal matters. As one theologian put it in a lecture in the Abbey 2 weeks ago, truth is both a given and work in progress. If the Nolan principles do define the framework within which public service is expected to work, we have not lost our understanding of why truth matters in the ordering of our society and where good may be found. But these principles are not a magic key. The task of public service in striving to do the right thing is hard and it's complicated. If a fundamental part of the civil servant's role is to work for the good of society, given the multitude of conflicting pressures and constraints which he or she must work under every day, doing what is right is impossible without a moral roadmap. That roadmap is the Nolan principles. Those principles, as I have said, are defined by a striving after truth. But of course, whose truth? One government's truth is not another's. Governments set the boundaries of where they want the truth to be, and that will direct or distort the role of the civil servant to tell truth under power, since, as we've seen, a government may define the truth only in terms of what it wants to believe. The civil servant's task may then be only to deliver the best answer, best in relation to that defined path of truth, the best answer that he can in the circumstances. I've seen this often in my earlier career. Just think of the decision to go to war with Iraq in 2003. Think of the Brexit arguments now, where whatever side of the debate you're on, the civil servant's task is to make the best of the impossibly challenging hand he's been given. And there are occasions when the action needed relates only to a part of the truth, not the truth of the entire issue, or where the issue is such that different aspects of the truth have different weight. I personally recall one such example in 1989, when Britain's relations with Iraq became embroiled in the fate of a dual national British-Iraqi journalist who was arrested by the Iraqis, accused of spying, and sentenced to death. The cynic might have said, to preserve the quality of our wider but difficult relations with Iraq, to protect our trade, to protect the jobs in Britain which stem from it, we should let Iraqi justice take its course. But that dimension of the truth carried no weight against a more urgent and important truth, the threat to the life of a man who, whatever the wider politics, should not be allowed to die in that way. I and my colleagues used every diplomatic weapon we could over a hectic and desperate weekend, including personal intervention by the Prime Minister, to persuade the Iraqis to be lenient. We failed, and the man was executed. My point is that reality and truth are often multi-layered. The choices they provide may be contradictory, they may be uncomfortable, but without a moral map to guide an understanding of where truth should lead you, making those choices will be arbitrary or simply wrong. As I have said, the Nolan principles help provide this moral map, and the Abbey Institute sees this commitment to the pursuit of truth vividly in the many contacts we have with public servants of all kinds. But that's not to view public service in a misty-eyed or over-forgiving way. There are faults, blemishes, inadequacies wherever we care to look. But if those committed to public service are guided by these aspirations, as I believe they overwhelmingly are, however impeded in delivery they may be by resources, by inconsistent leadership, by public misunderstanding, or by misrepresentation in the media, this is a beacon of light in the core of our system of governance, which is, I believe, cause for hope. And finally, alongside these principles of good governance is, for me, the more pervasive, yet more intangible support of religious belief itself. We are this evening in one of the great glories of English Gothic architecture. This abbey is a majestic canvas on which is painted the outpourings of centuries of human creativity and commitment. These stones and these spaces have echoed every single day for 1,000 years to prayer and the recognition of our imperfections as human beings. To me, this abbey is a powerful, reassuring, and lasting symbol of our commitment to the importance of truth and the importance of striving after that truth. Other important symbols in the very nature of Parliament Square lie around us. Law, Parliament, and Whitehall are all contributors in their own different ways to the symphony of truth in our society, as does the Abbey itself in its enduring contribution to the ultimate reality and the ultimate truth. For each of these institutions, this is, I believe, a fundamental responsibility. Just as in the pursuit of scientific truth, there's always more to achieve and to understand if we are to make the right choices for a civilized society. But unlike the pursuit of scientific truth, we constantly find ourselves inventing and reinventing ideas and strategies which ignore or misunderstand the facts around us. Our history is littered with examples of such abject failures. Yet in this majestic embodiment of Christian faith, which the Abbey is, I feel, alongside all that Christian belief represents, an affirmation of why truth matters, why the continuing struggle to recognize where truth lies can never be ignored, and why that struggle must not cease. Sustaining truth is therefore both a commitment and a process. It'll always be easier to recognize where we've made past mistakes than to ensure the right choices for the future. But if we are to make progress in building a fair and just world, if we are to work insofar as we ever can for the triumph of good over evil, we cannot afford to withdraw from the conscious struggle to frame our actions according to an honest perception of where truth lies. And while we pursue that course, we must be alert to whatever threatens that ideal. Truth, unsustained, is a society ultimately compromised. The choice before us, as individuals and as members of society, is ultimately whether we seek to sustain it or to undermine it. Thank you very much.
Well, I know you will all now agree with me that Sir Stephen is an outstanding guide to the difference between truth and fiction and reality and fantasy. And I would describe him myself as, in his words, a beacon of light. The Beacon of Light has, I'm very pleased to say, agreed to answer some of your questions. So, who would like to start? If you put up your hand, and then there are microphones here which will come to you, and if you would be good enough to perhaps stand up and to say your name, and if you represent any organization, that would be helpful. Who would like to start? Lady Susan.
Thank you very much indeed. That was wonderful. Thank you, Stephen. I really hesitate to be the first, but I'm leaping into a sort of a shy gap. If you define truth as... It really is a concept, because it is the nearest to the facts that emerge. And that must necessarily mean that truth is a movable concept. It's not an absolute. It can't be an absolute. And if you take, for example, the Brexit argument, it is entirely possible that as facts emerge, that there are an equal number of facts demonstrating the advantages of both leaving and as facts emerge. So there are two truths, because they're two realities, and they coexist. And that's why they can't really be an absolute truth. They can only be a hypothesis which remains unchallenged for a considerable length of time, but then it disappears once it is challenged by the facts. I don't think that's a question. I think...
Yes. I comment on it even so, Francis. Thank you very much. I mean, on one of your points, if I were a theologian, which I am not, as I say, I would say that there certainly is ultimate and absolute truth, but it's something which, in a sense, this abbey represents and stands for and embodies, but it's not actually something, perhaps, which informs the way in which, for example, the Brexit debate takes place. And I just did describe truth as, I think, myself as a search and a process for trying to get closer to the facts, to reality. And of course, the way in which one sees those facts and reality obviously does evolve and change, just as in scientific research, those facts and that reality evolve and change because one understands them better, more closely than one did perhaps in the past. I think human beings live with ambiguity. They live with contradictions, and that's part of our existence. I think that's unavoidable. I think what I would say about the Brexit debate, however, is that what that pursuit of different kinds of truth does need to be based on, as I said a moment ago, is not least a sense of honesty and integrity in pursuing those facts, of not saying, well, I'll ignore those facts because they don't actually agree with my argument, I'll just take those that do. Because that actually is not a way to be honest about what one's trying to do. It's not an honest basis on which to base action. And I made that point because I do think it's very important that, I mean, this is not just a kind of an abstract debate. The fact of the matter is that those choices that you make about the truth as you perceive it to be, as you want other people to perceive it to be, is the basis on which you actually then act, you actually conduct policy, you actually make changes to the society around you, which is depending upon you as a government to do the right thing. So that perception of truth does matter. Of course it changes, of course it evolves, but it's something which, you know, if you don't grasp the importance of that central concept of struggling for what is valid, what is as close as you can get to the facts as they are rather than as you want them to be, I think you actually end up with government which is not going to be responsible and which in the end it may not well be believed. And if it's not believed, of course, you get into a different kind of world entirely.
Do I see your hand?
So at the end, I left feeling actually I'm not sure you can draw this distinction between fact and the search for fact and truth, as opposed to feelings and belief. And you gave an example, which if I understood, and I may not have done, of the case you were dealing with where in Iraq there was a guy threatened with death. And you said the deeper truth was, you know, the importance of the preservation of life or something along those lines. Well, that, in one sense, is a belief. It's a feeling. It's not a fact, I think, in the way that, you know, you were describing facts. So is it not the case that to really grapple with truth is trying to understand facts and feelings and beliefs? And I wonder whether, you know, this is why we've sort of ended up in a debate or, you know, sort of historical development of modernism into postmodernism, because the simple statement you can rely, you know, is the search for facts, actually isn't in the end a strong enough foundation upon which to build.
Well, I talked about the Nolan principles as a roadmap, which helped you, to define ways in which you think the right answer, where the right answer might lie. I mean, I take your point entirely that, in a sense, one's trying to combine the fact, the objective fact, the fact out there of that man in prison about to be sentenced or has been sentenced to death, about to die, and well, there's a belief that his life should be preserved. There's, I think, also the fact that by and large, people would assume that good government would actually try to do the right thing by someone so condemned. So all these things, right, seem to me a combination of fact and belief. And when I was as a diplomat, one worked in a world in which you had to combine those two things. But part of the... I mean, perhaps I chose a bad example from the point of view of my argument. But what I would just repeat, I think, is the fact that one of those principles that Nolan describes is honesty. And honesty in terms of trying to do the right thing in the right way in the circumstances as you perceive them, I mean, is in itself, it may be a belief and opinion, but it's also a fact also, because the fact of the matter is that if people will judge you and your actions on whether they think you have done the right, the honest, the courageous or the proper thing. So these things get mixed up together. I don't think the one, in a sense, invalidates the other.
Yes, ma'am. Just in the front here. Thank you.
And also, in defence of your point in relation to that last example, could it not be argued that there are different kinds of truth, so that, for example, you can have factual truths about things which are out there or whether Lord Sarchi's glasses are going to break if they fall on the ground, and also moral truths? And I think if one allows that there can be such a thing as a moral truth, then could you not say that it is a moral truth that life should be preserved, for example, or however one wanted to define it more precisely, so that in a sense it isn't just a matter of opinion, or it might not be just a matter of opinion, if one allows there can be a category of moral truths?
There are lots of ways to try and approach an understanding of truth. And in one respect, I think, if I may say, that the point about moral truth comes back to Francis' point about the fact that there isn't any absolute truth. Moral truth, to my understanding, as I say, again, as a non-theologian, and there are many people in this room better equipped to answer this question this way than I am, but moral truth does depend upon a relationship, it seems to me, between a perception of what the good is and why the good means that it is good, because it's related to an ultimate truth which is bigger than the concept of, you know, is it right that I should actually break that person's arm or not? So, I mean, thank you, A, for supporting what I was saying, but B, I would also say that, yes, there are lots of different kinds of truth, and you have to try and somehow find your way through this maze to get to the answer of, you know, what is more honest in terms of what reality that I perceive is, what is more honest in terms of, therefore, the action that I think I ought to take. And that truth may be, as I say, multi-layered, but you can't just take one as being the only answer. You have to try and look at a wider picture. I said, I think, early on in my talk that the truth is never easy. It isn't ever easy. But the important thing is that one doesn't actually give up on the effort and the struggle to try and find out where you think it lies. Gentleman over there.
Coming. This is Claire Foster Gilbert, who is, as many of you know, the founder director of the Westminster Abbey Institute.
Thank
Claire
you.
Foster Gilbert.
Stephen, thank you for your lecture and some fantastic phrases. The one I wanted to just ask you to speak a bit more about was truth is the product of care, reason, and effort. And you also spoke about the neutering of discernment when you claim truth is my truth. In a world that's speeding up, and particularly in trying to govern a world that's speeding up, how can we find time for that kind of careful discernment and careful care, reason, and what are your words? They're beautiful. Care, reason, and effort that are needed to reach to the truth when you're trying to run a country.
None of these things is easy. And if I think back to ministers that I've worked for in my time, the ones who I think were most effective and the ones who could cope best with the pressures of events, and events come upon you all the time, like an avalanche, like a tsunami of events happen all the time, you don't have a lot of time to trying to find the right answer. So if you're not to be sort of cast adrift on a kind of sea of uncertainty and contradiction and impossibility, you do need, it seems to me, to have a strong sense of what you believe in, where you think right choices happen to lie, where you think goodness is to be found. You have to, in a sense, you have to have, whether it's Nolan or something else, something much bigger, but you have to have your own, if you like, roadmap to help your way, to sift your way through these contradictory facts. And if I might just say one similar point about my time in the royal household. I was working with somebody who was constantly assailed by a whole realm of contradictory facts, and assailed by a world which was always keen to criticize, keen to condemn, keen to find fault, but never keen to accept and understand what one was trying to actually to do. The way in which that person, in a sense, kept a sense of what the right answers were, was to have a strong sense of where, in a sense, his path was, what his principles were, where his morals were, which gave him that roadmap to find an answer. I don't believe, if you're a minister in a government, you can actually do your job without having a degree of inner conviction about what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is not. To do that, I think, gives you an ability to, despite the pressure of events, to exercise some discernment and some integrity in what you do. But it's pretty difficult.
I think gentleman over there. In the corner, yes. Please.
Thank you. I'm David. I work at the Foreign Office. And I'm going to struggle to express this, and thanks to Claire for taking half of my question. I think what I'm trying to work through is the question of truth in society at the moment, and whether there's a greater good question, which is a little bit of what you've just answered, but whether or not in a world where we're more individual and truth is more individual, there is the same space for a collective truth on issues of the day, whatever they may be, and whether in the past we've accepted somehow that there is a fact or facts upon which we can start to make argument and make our own versions of the truth. I wonder if we don't see the same facts anymore because we see ourselves as individual characters in a play rather than as a society. And if we don't see ourselves as a society, how do we deal with truth?
I mean, you raise a very important question. If you are an individual character in a play and you don't relate to the other people on the stage, the play doesn't mean very much, doesn't have very much meaning, it doesn't have any substance to it. In a sense, what you're, I think, asking about is what is the kind of contemporary nature of what makes possible a society at all? My own understanding of society is that it's actually always been, through history, in lots of different forms, of course, a system within which people actually are prepared to make compromises about themselves in order to be able to exist within a framework of greater good. So, if you go back to the 18th century philosophers who took the view that the primitive man realized that actually, in order to be able to have a better life, you have to make compromises with other people. I mean, that is the kind of basis on which you can form a view about how society works. What I don't personally understand is that, as you're already saying, I think, that because the trend of today's society is actually to, if you like, reduce that area or that willingness for compromise and to exalt the fact, as I was myself saying, that my view is what matters rather than anybody else's, that my perception of the truth matters more than anybody else's, you're getting to a point where what that means in terms of what sustains and goes on sustaining a civilized society becomes, I think, difficult to understand. I can't myself see how that illogicality progresses without actually taking the view that no matter how much the individual's own views and opinions and self-regard may be exalted by the march of modern technology, unless at the same time you preserve a sense of if you like, where those perhaps higher truths lie, or where that sense of what it is that actually makes for a civilized society which is not just about me lies, if you're not prepared to make those kinds of choices, I don't see where the logic of where we are today goes in any other direction than down a path of increasing social anarchy. But I don't believe we're going to get to that point. What stops us getting there, I think, remains to be seen. I don't think we'll get there.
Yes, in the corner.
Just slightly building on that last point. If truth is a complex process and perhaps an intellectual battle to be won, can truth, or even is truth, an egalitarian concept? Is it something that's in general reach to anyone and everyone? And if not, is that not the main cause of these challenges in the world, like the Trump administration or Brexit? And is there an antidote to it?
Is there an antidote to it? Well, I mean, I wish there was an easy antidote to it. But one of the great paradoxes of society is the fact that in a democratic society, however you want to define that, if you have a majority of people who actually don't care about what you might call principles of honesty, integrity, truthfulness, or whatever, then you are on a road to, if you like, to sort of self-destruction. I suppose the romantic in me would simply say this to you, that however bad things may be seen to be becoming, there often comes a point at which somehow, for whatever reason, whatever motor lies behind it, the pendulum match begins to swing in the opposite direction, and people begin to think to themselves, this is not actually the right thing to be doing, the right way to be going. This is somewhere, at this point, one begins to find that values begin to swing back or to change or whatever. I mean, society's values do change. They do evolve. I mean, I'll give you just one small example. I mean, if you compare today the extremely moralizing attitude of the media in terms of the behavior of public figures, that is something which, in a sense, if it were to go on in this direction, would actually make public service, seems to me, in 20 years' time, probably
impossible unless it was done entirely by a community of saints. Now, we know that that's not going to happen. At some point, it may be that people begin to say that this is absurd, because actually what we want from people is not to know that they are, from the moment when they could actually begin to exercise moral judgments, they have been people of total, utter, and unimpeachable purity. We just want people who actually can do the right thing in the right way for society's good. If we get to that point, the trend may stop. I think that the trend will stop at that point, but these things are very difficult to predict, and it may be that we'll have to go through some even worse years of Trump-like government administration before we get to that point. But I do have the faith, or the hope, or the desperate hope that we will actually get there.
Yes. Probably helpful to stand, if you wouldn't mind.
Of course. Nicholas Hopton. Stephen, thank you for your elucidation, as ever. I serve at the moment in a country which you served in, towards the beginning of your career, and where there is, at the moment, a slightly Orwellian approach to truth, where it is plausibly argued by the government and administration that it is perfectly acceptable to say things publicly which do not correspond in any way to the facts or the truth as you've approached defining it. And it is used as a justification as being for the greater good and for the progress of that society by the people in power and much of the population at times. Like you, I tend to the optimistic view that there is a magnetic pole to which humanity always eventually swings back, whatever one calls it, but it's in the direction of truth, and that one doesn't ever end up at the other pole. So I hope you're right, and I share your view on that. But in the context of all that, and in the reflections on your career over time in different contexts, can you reflect in any way on the role of truth in Iran, which is a very topical subject, of course, at the moment?
Well, Nicholas, you're much, much more up-to-date than I am, and not least given where you're now serving. I suppose it would be just right to say a word about the fact that, I mean, what's happening in Iran in this sense, I mean, however you view it, is not, in a sense, unknown in human history. I mean, there are many, many regimes which, in a sense, claim a monopoly of the truth, and they use the truth for the, quote, greater good, at the same time as masking a complete disregard for what actually is fair and just and reasonable and right. So Iran isn't different from that point of view. I suppose I think all I would say is that as time goes on, it seems to me, and it's now been however many years since 1979, when the revolution in Iran took place, replacing one not entirely pleasant regime with a much, I think, more unpleasant regime and a much more intolerant and narrow-minded and, I think, probably, in terms of the good of the country, probably more destructive than the previous regime could ever have dreamt of being. There comes a point at which, in a sense, to go back to your optimism word, I think people do begin to realize that this just isn't an acceptable way in which to run a country. And then, of course, the equation becomes, well, at what point is it impossible for the powers of control and repression of a regime to stop that kind of feeling coming to the surface and changing it? And these things do happen, but they're not predictable. And if you again go back to 1979 or 78 in Iran, it wasn't predicted by almost any of us, apart from, if you like, those who were thought of as being completely lunatic or absurd, that the regime of the Shah could actually fail, and yet it did fail. And there rose to the surface a view that somehow this was a repressive regime which could not survive, could not be allowed to continue. People do, at a certain point, they rise up and want to make changes. Who would have predicted in 1789 that France would have done the same? In a world in which the Bourbons seem to be as autocratically powerful and repressive as the Pahlavi regime was in Iran in 79 itself. What I think I would say to you is that these things, I mean, they do have a habit of moving on. Things are never as permanent as they might be in human affairs, as they were indeed in Soviet Russia. That they weren't. When I grew up, there was a view that Soviet Russia could not possibly change, not in our lifetime. It was inconceivable. Now, of course, the cynic would say it hasn't changed at all now. It just has different people in the top. But there was a moment, there was a sort of Moscow spring when you felt actually this might be possible. These things can change. Whether Iran will in the near future, gosh, I'd like to think it would, but you'll know better the answer to that.
Well, then I might exercise my prerogative. In the audience, very distinguished audience, there are very distinguished public servants, and they, as part of their duties, are asked frequent questions. Perhaps the most frequently asked question would be in the Palace of Westminster or Whitehall or Downing Street or here or round the square, would be, how are you? Well, they can all manage that. But the next most frequently asked question probably would be, in any of those places, is that true? How should they answer that question?
Well, I would say there's one simple answer to that, is you have to answer these questions honestly. And it seems to me that one of the important roles of the civil servant is, whatever happens, to be honest. And your minister may not like the answer to his question, is that true, when the answer is it absolutely is, minister. The point is that you have, as a civil servant, to be prepared to stand up for what you believe, but equally you have to know what you are standing for in the first place. You have to know your facts, you have to know your ground, you have to know that what you're saying is actually the right advice. The paradox, of course, is that ministers may then say, having asked the question, is that true, may then say, I don't care if it is true, we're doing X rather than Y. And the civil servant's job then is quite, to me, quite straightforward, and I defer to my colleagues in the Foreign Office here, but at the end of the day, your job is to make the best of what the decision of your ministers happens to be. Or if you feel that's unacceptable, then you have a different choice to make. Fortunately, I think that most civil servants are very loyal to the departments of which they're part. They're loyal to the governments of which they are an important instrument. And they will actually, in the end, do what it is that their minister so decides. But it may not be the thing that they themselves would feel was the right answer or the truthful answer, but it's the one in which they've been instructed to perform. It's not an easy role to be a public servant or a civil servant. It's often, I think, very undervalued in terms of the difficulty it has to undergo. And I come back, if I may, Maurice, just very briefly to what I said when I was speaking before, which is that I do believe that there is an extraordinarily deep-seated loyalty and commitment to doing the right thing, which informs, fortunately and blessedly, the way in which our public service operates.
Well, will you all join me in showing appreciation for what Sir Stephen has said, his analysis, and, if I may say so in particular, his optimistic last statement? Would you? Well done. Congratulations.